All right, hello everyone. Let's wake up. Right, come on, let's put some life into this. I'm not going to talk about economics too much, just a little bit in the middle. The background to this is a paper I just did in Egypt, so if you're interested in the sort of the macro framework, it's derived from that. This is really about politics. So my basic shtick was I used to worry about the future of the euro, now I worry about the sustainability of the EU. And I think that's because the politics of this moment are far more important than the economics. And if we just focus on what's the appropriate policy mix and should we have less money and more fiscal or whatever, we're kind of missing the woods for the trees. So let's see what's going on. So a simple question, Boris Johnson. I mean, really? This is credible in any sense, in any universe? And yet, 1.6 million people thought that he was right, more than people who thought that hanging around with the people who are your major markets for the past 40 years would be a good idea. And it's not as if this is the only example of bad stuff happening. There's a little rogues gallery of the right. And just in case you think I'm being partisan, there's one from the left. Now, what do they all have in common? Brexit is part of something much, much bigger than simply looking at Brexit. So here's the policy mistake, number one, trying to treat this in isolation. If we think that this is basically a problem for the EU and that we have to manage the Brits, then there's a question, which I call the Goldilocks question. Do you make the exit too hot or do you make it too cold? Because if you do what Hollande suggested the other day, quite foolishly, but I take that as de rigueur, for Hollande, unfortunately. He said, let's punish them. But the problem is Britain's too big to fail. And if you make them fail, it will rebound and hurt you. And given relative growth rates, you probably don't want to do this. Second one, though, is unfortunately if you let them out the door too easily, then you will turn the whole place into a buffet without direction. And the entire thing will collapse. So that's a really difficult problem. Now, once you get the Brits out, you get back to EU politics as normal, which these days, in the mind of much of the public, is tear-gassing pensioners in Greece for no apparent reason and permanently long unemployment lines. We've lost sight as to what this entire project is for. No one seems to be able to articulate it anymore and give it a positive vision. I saw this first as a symptom when Scotland had its referendum in 2014. The one side that was dealing in fantasy economics, the nationalists, had a consistent message of hope. There was something there, even though the economics were complete bullshit. On the other hand, what did we have to stay? Fear. And what are we playing now? More fear. Fear is a losing hand in politics over the long run. So this is probably not how to think about the problem. In isolation and in unconnected to the rise of the new right, especially the collapse of the old left, I'll get onto that. The graph on the right-hand side is the collapse of the combined vote share of left parties. That's pretty scary. The hollowing out of domestic party systems and the collapse in support for centre parties. And the claim that I'm making is very simple. Once you get away from looking at Brexit as just another policy that we'll manage through the traditional narrative that the EU always expands in moments of crisis, which is also empirically false. It actually expands when things are going really well. No one launched EMU in the middle of a crisis, we might want to remember. But what's really going on here is both the centre-left and the centre-right on the level of the member states are the ultimate backstops and support for the entire European project. But we've become so used to thinking about this as a self-sustaining set of technocratic institutions that somehow has a life of its own that we're forgetting what happens if those parties lose power in a permanent way. If there is a break in the time series of rule, then we really are up the paddle, or up the creek without a paddle, I should say. So what's an alternative frame that connects Brexit to Trump, to Bernie Sanders, to Die Linke, and help us solve the EU's perma-crisis? So this is the little bit of sort of my macro-political economy I've thrown in here. I like to call it this, and I'm sure many of you know this, this is Kalecki's famous piece from 1943, where he basically detects the bug in the software that basically Keynes was writing for macroeconomics. And the story is very simple for those of you who don't know it. He said back in 1943 in a seven-page paper devoid of Greek letters that the 1970s were coming, that essentially if you create permanent full employment and sustain that, labour can move costlessly from job to job and can strike at will. We saw the spike in strike rates from the late 1960s onwards as they tried to regain real wage share in the face of inflation. But the inflation itself is generated by the fact that the reservation wage wage has consistently been bid up, and there's no incentives for politicians to deflate at the top of the cycle. Business can only restore profits by raising prices, which eats into wages, produces more inflation, and the result of that inflation is a collapse of investment, which shows up in unemployment, in other words, stagnation. It's actually quite easy to explain the thing that was supposedly so difficult to explain in the 1970s. Kalecki then said, what is business going to do in such a world? And in the same piece, he said that they would fund a market-friendly political revolution. They would discipline organised labour. Simply look at strike rates across the world and you'll see that. And also, very interestingly, hand over policy to technocrats. And you don't have to get into fancy arguments about time inconsistency or Ricardian expectations. It's baked into the cake. What he didn't foresee was things that augmented these trends, the globalisation of production, the deregulation of finance, and the return to gold standard type mechanisms of adjustment. That is to say, particularly in a common currency, that you have to do internal devaluation rather than external forms of adjustment. So if the post-war order that Kalecki saw undermined itself, are we living in the end of the current regime? So let's think about this for a second. That's the end of the Kaleckian regime, what I like to call the debtor's paradise. Sustained inflation, labour's share of national income at an all-time high, corporate profits at an all-time low, unions were strong, inequality was low, national markets relatively closed, capital controls in some cases, weak finance, central banks are essentially check-cashing agencies for the Treasury, and parliaments actually did stuff. Without going through the same thing on the other side, now what I like to call the creditor's paradise of today, secular disinflation, capital share of income at all-time high, wages at an all-time low, it's a complete reversal. Now, if one of them was endogenously unstable, who's to say the other one isn't? And if you think about it that way, Brexit and a lot of other things that are out there start to make sense, because all you need to do for a moment is think about the winners and losers in this situation. So if you have deflation or systemic deflation and democracy, who wins and who loses? Well, that's where it gets quite interesting. Creditors are losers because the value of debt goes up, but your ability to collect goes down. So highly financialized economies where the real value of debt goes up, but the ability to collect goes down, produces certain effects. Those centre-left parties, I'm thinking New Labour, I'm thinking the SPD, I'm thinking even the Swedish SAP, that have been very market-friendly over the past 20 years, who have, to all intents and purposes, given up on the bottom 20% of the income distribution and moved to the centre, are getting hammered. And they're getting hammered because they are what I've called them before, the second-hand enforcers of a creditor's paradise. And once you move to the middle and it turns out the people in the middle are fickle and they don't have to stay with you, you run into a lot of trouble. Now, the other side of that equation was harder to fathom. What's happening to the centre-right? And it turns out, as we've seen now, it's not just the SPD getting 19% in regional elections you have to worry about. It's the fact that Frau Merkel herself is in problems, because it turns out people don't like immigrants. And we can talk about the reasons why, but that starts to eat away a bit at the centre as well. So you have a debtors' coalition emerging on the other side, where you can't pay, won't pay, will vote. And you have the rise of populism and political parties of the right, which essentially have one thing in common, even with the left. They want national markets. They want an end to globalisation. They don't like the euro. And above all, they don't like the idea of something being different, foreign, cosmopolitan, which at the end of the day is exactly what the EU is premised upon. So we should be very worried about this. Now, if this is a plausible macro story, how can we begin to address this? Well, it depends on how you define this moment. And there's two definitions floating around, and I see it very much being a Scot who lives in the United States, but you also see it here. The first one is, everyone's a racist. All of a sudden, everyone's a racist. I find that one hard, personally. I know that some of them are. Some even in my own family have decidedly dodgy, predilections when it comes to spouting off about Islam and immigration. But these people weren't always there. They weren't there in the 1990s. When real wage growth was there, such parties that represented these so-called interests really had no traction. Now, there is actually something very interesting in the Brexit vote about this. It was anti-immigrant. There was this fact that rich areas and poor areas alike both voted for Brexit. The old voted more, and they tend to be more racist. That anti-immigrant Muslim sentiment is rising, etc., etc. But the second one is the economic story. And the counterfactual on the everyone suddenly racist story is that the economy doesn't matter. So put this in the context of Europe, that running a near decade-long recession with depression-like conditions in many countries in the periphery, with massive youth unemployment, with stagnant, if not falling, real wages for many parts of the population, doesn't matter. People just got really pissed about Muslims. That just doesn't stack up for me. And if you look at the empirical work on this, there's a lot of it out there that says, well, if you take economics as not just being a simple function of the Gini coefficient or simply the average wage rate, that it correlates with things like Chinese import competition, with health inequalities, really correlates very high with the growth of job insecurity. If you look at surveys on how people feel insecure in their job, that's when they really start to defect from the centre of the political system. So there is an economic story here which I think is very powerful, but I also think that's the right one. And here's why. If you choose a policy frame that essentially gives in to what I'll call the trumpets of the world, then what do you do? What exactly is the public policy solution? You turn the EU into Canada? Well, that would be great if we could all be so cosmopolitan, but that's not going to happen. Or alternatively, what? End the free movement of labour? Start immigration restrictions? Stick Hungarian-type walls up everywhere? Because if we do, we might as well shut up the shop now, because that's where that leads. On the other hand, even if it is more complex than it's just the economy, stupid, that at least gives you some leverage. But to do that, you need to rehabilitate the centre. And that means that people have to start owning things, like the fact that maybe over the past 20 years, they kind of have stuffed the working classes of Europe to a certain extent and sold them on a fantasy of globalisation and everybody has skills and everyone rises together in a world of inequality and in a world in which distributions are seriously skewed. You can stop, it's very easy, the pro-cyclical squeezing of budgets. You can change the numbers, we can do all the things that we've been talking about today. There are many possible policies. But the trick here is, we can sit in this room all the time and talk about better policies. Somebody has to own this. Someone has to argue for this. And this is what I think is really important. Change the definition of what's going on. But who can do this? And this is the paradox of where the EU is at the moment. The member states are locked into a fiscal framework that prevents more active pro-growth measures and generates a subterranean banking crisis, amongst other pathologies. Chronically low growth is the real problem. Having authored those rules or openly signed on to them, it's impossible for those states to then turn around and break them openly. To give one example, it's absolutely true that Renzi needs to bail his banks. Public money solves banking crises. You can write down all the rules you want about bail-ins and creditors and cocoa bonds and all the rest of it. It doesn't work like that. At the end of the day, states are lenders of last resort. If you write rules that say you can't do that, you're basically putting a call option out there on equities and banks going to zero. It's just a question of time. This is ludicrous. You have to stop this. But once you've authored those rules and said, we won't do this, we won't intervene, state aid is bad, then you're bringing around the very problems that you're trying to avoid. That's the paradox that we need to break. Now, Martin Sandbrun in the Financial Times had a column recently, which I wholeheartedly agreed with, said, ironically, the only part of the EU that can really do this is the Commission, because their recommendations, unless they're overturned by majority vote, are actually binding. So if anybody needs to change the definition of what's going on, it's actually the technocrats. Now, how much of a screwed-up world is this, whereby the people who have the room for manoeuvre to make a political intervention is the technocracy, and the people that we put in charge in parliaments to actually make these decisions can't do it because of the rules themselves they've authored, which means that they have no room for manoeuvre. I think that's a political crisis. I think we're really stuffed, and if we're not careful, we're going to lose the lot. So the bigger issue is these guys eat your lunch. And the folks that might be helpful on the left, you spend all your time trying to isolate, alienate, defame, get rid of. But at the same time, no one's flocking back to the middle. So what happens to the supports? So at the end of the day, I think the EU might actually be more at risk than the euro. This is the hidden lesson of Brexit. If you think about it as a policy choice, Europe's a thing, it's hermetically sealed, it's going to manage this problem, it's a question of dealing with the Brits. Totally the wrong way of looking at it. This double bind on policy action is eating away at the centre-left and now the centre-right. And we're in a world where Spain, remember, this is the success case, right? 20% unemployment, 5% deficit, 100% debt to GDP, that's the good example. They can't form a government. Italy will fall because of the stupid referendum they're causing. France may go the way of Spain, and the UK will go for a hard Brexit, and the German SPD is probably one, if not two, steps away from extinction. So you don't have much time. So while it's comforting for all of us to basically sit around and talk about the optimal policy mix, we still have to start doing some real politics, or all the institutions we've built can go very, very fast. Thank you.